Okay, life can be crazy. You're feeling like you're sinking. Just trying to find a meaning. It's time for better thinking. Yeah, better thinking. Time to tune in. Let's go.
Welcome back to Better Thinking. My name's Nesh Nikolic, and my guest today is Dr. Janet Hall. Dr. Jan is a retired psychologist of 40 years and still works as a hypnotherapist, sex therapist, author, professional speaker, trainer, and media consultant. Dr. Jan consults regularly with print media and is a frequent guest on Talkback Radio and current affairs shows. Dr. Jan was a regular for 2 years on the Sex Life television program in Australia, and she uses user-friendly strategies that offer practical solutions to sexual and relationship issues, making her knowledge accessible for all. It was a great pleasure to speak with Dr. Jan today to talk about how sex has changed in sex education, the experience of sexual dysfunction has changed over the course of her experience in her lifetime, and understand some of the difficulties that are facing the modern person, particularly around children being exposed to pornography early on in life. I hope you enjoy the show, because I certainly did. And it was nice to talk about a difficult, or I suppose, taboo topic so freely and openly with Dr. Jan. Enjoy. Dr. Jan, a big thank you for coming onto the show today.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to it.
Likewise. Look, I need to start with talking about your experience. I know that you've been in the field of psychology for, more than how old I am. And that says something in terms of your experience, the breadth of knowledge that you bring, the different avenues of therapy that you've practiced. So how about we start there and let our listeners find out a little bit about that?
Yes, well, I studied just undergrad psych at Monash University, and that was very rats and stats. And I thought, no, I'm not that interested in this kind of research, and I want to work with people. And so I'd find myself sneaking off and reading behavioral journals in the biomed at Monash because I was fascinated by them, and also hypnosis. So I followed that through with all of my work and found that to be invaluable.
And I know that you've looked at work all the way from, you know, parenting to hypnosis through to, you know, being a sex therapist and helping couples in their relationships together. Can you talk me through a little bit about how you progressed through those spaces? How do those different areas, you know, present, and what made them attractive for you to sort of lean into?
Well, yes, and because behaviorism was really just sort of like now becoming accepted in the 1970s, and I wanted to have children. Parent, they say that you teach best what you need to learn for yourself. And so I just really loved learning about parenting. And then I wrote the 6 books. The one I'm most proud of is called Fear-Free Children, How Parents Can Help Anxious Children. There was a lot about aggressive or overactive, hyperactive kids, but very little about helping anxious kids. And the actual month that book was launched by its publisher was the year the Twin Towers were bombed. And kids like all around the world were terrified of what might happen next. So it was very timely. But after a while, Nesh, I did get rather, I don't know, I couldn't say bored, because raising children is never boring. But I wanted to really explore something that was perhaps a little bit more challenging at that time. And there wasn't much sex therapy going on in Australia. There wasn't an accreditation, and there was just a chance really for me to take whatever visiting overseas speakers would come to Australia. And at that time, they were starting to bring them in. And so I just went to everything I could. We didn't have internet in those days, of course, and read everything that I could about sex therapy, and just found that I had an absolute fascination for it. And the one thing that I do pride myself on is always being user-friendly. And the Fear Free Children books has, you know, 12 good ideas for busting fears. And so when I started to work in sex therapy, I thought, what do people most need to learn? They need to learn to communicate. And I think that's one of the main things. You know, the holding people back for even going for sex therapy in those days, because for men with their perhaps erectile dysfunction or premature ejaculation, they had a really, I don't want to talk about this. Does this make me not a man? And, you know, the whole thing now is so much more open, and men and women are able to seek out some kind of sex coaching and, of course, healing. Because a lot of the sexual problems of people that come to see a sex therapist have unfortunately started in either their lack of sexual education or a very prohibitive sex education. My daughter Ella is a tantric sex therapist, and she and I have done together a series of videos and assessments for women. And as sad as it is, the question that we sort of keep coming back to over and over again to a woman is, what did your mother teach you about sex? And the answer is just so often nothing, or don't get pregnant. So for so many women, sex was just not normalized. And in terms of men, unfortunately, in the last, say, 15 to 20 years, with pornography being the basic first real opportunity to learn about sex, the young men are getting very twisted ideas about what women really want. And they're just the whole thing about sex education is just so necessary, needs to be open, and often still isn't.
Mm-hmm. How has the world of sex therapy changed? You know, what are the kinds of issues that you are seeing now these days arising more than, let's say, when you first started? Has it moved through phases? Have you seen anything in particular arise in certainly these last, you know, 5 or so years? Has COVID changed anything with you know, so many changes? Has the internet, obviously, as you mentioned, with maybe some pornography, has changed the world? What have you noticed in your experience?
Well, in the late, I always forget the date, that there was a big crash in Australia, the financial crash, late 90s, was it? Up until then, men were reluctant to put their hands up. But unfortunately, a lot of men lost either a job, they lost a fortune, and they found themselves so overwhelmed with stress that they lost the ability to perform sexually. And we didn't have the little blue pill of Viagra or any other magic wand that men expect. I actually keep a magic wand here to show people that it's just a piece of plastic. And I like to say to them, men and women, the magic is in you, and the willingness to be honest with me and read and learn and immerse and study and to be the best lover that you can be. So for men, they started to come in saying, I can't get an erection. And then when Viagra, Levitra, Cialis were introduced, then they kind of stopped coming so much. But then the premature ejaculators would put their hand up and say, you know, like when I do watch pornography, it seems like, you know, there's nothing good about my lack of ability to last in bed. And am I abnormal? And unfortunately, with premature ejaculation, they call it the young man's curse and the old man's nightmare. That is that so many young men do get so excited so quickly that they are unable to control themselves. And so many older men look back on it and think, oh, I never want to be so feel so incompetent in my life, in my sexual life again. So with women, currently, I think maybe I have a reputation with doctors now as being a specialist in painful sex or vaginismus, which is when the vagina, basically the pelvic floor really, freezes up and the penis is unable to enter because the woman has so much fear and so much pain. Let's face it, who wants to put their hand up for something that hurts, like severely hurts? So with men now, I have a total devotion to those women who have sexual pain, and that's where hypnosis can be very powerful to overcome the fear and rewrite the negative history. And with men, mostly men, it is the addiction to sex, whether it be to pornography, or whether it be to what I call going to massage parlors, going to meet escorts, and that is such a huge industry now, and so easy for men to fall into an addiction with.
And how do these presentations, in your experience, form? What are the primary areas that are correlated or that we understand are related to, why someone might be experiencing, pain while penetration is occurring for a woman, or why is there a certain number of men where, as a young man, for example, they might be having, greater excitement than others, and can't contain themselves and, ejaculate prematurely, or at least, before they wish to.
All right, well let's take the who should we take? Let's take the painful sex issue. And yet before I should do that, look, there's a whole umbrella really of Australia being now a melting pot. We have, I think the Indian population is the most quickly growing and the most, most extensive. And in terms of what did your parents or your mother teach you about sex question for those women, it's yes, don't do it, and don't ask me to talk about it. So a lot of those women who may have even been told by their mothers that sex is painful, that having babies is painful, that's a duty that you have to do for your husband. And that you never ever have it before marriage, and even during marriage, it's not something that you really are expected to like. It's a duty, and having children is, your job. So many of these young women from some sort of, interracial, or especially if they're oh, look, it's very distressing for me to actually even think of how many issues that they have. But they are the ones who most often come to have help for vaginismus, whereas women who brought up in, like, shall we say, all girls schools, it's so much better now. They're getting much better sex education. But about that 20 years ago, when pornography really started to be so available for girls and boys, a lot of the younger women are now keen to please the young man and even do things that they've seen in porn. And the young men think that that's what women want. So we have the really anxious women who feared the pain. And then you have the women who are keen, but just don't know how to talk about what they want. Let's face it, because they don't get much sex education, they don't know what they want.
So certainly for speaking for women predominantly, and obviously on a general basis, a lot of it is based on pain and fear around sex. Some of it being, I assume for some there might be medical reasons, but for many there are psychological reasons as to how someone was raised in terms of what, you know, expectations were around sex and what that might be like. And there was lots of pressure, you know, and concern and worry and fear that were might have been placed around that, that can sometimes have a relationship with, you know, experiencing pain during sex.
Yes, and, you know, 25 years ago, a lot of medical practitioners were very ignorant about these, the two main causes of sexual pain, the vaginismus, the frozen pelvic floor, the anxiety, and also vulvodynia, which is any kind of severe irritation of the vulva. Most women would go to see their GP, who wouldn't really have much knowledge about how to help or assist with those things. And in my book, which is called Sex Life Solutions, I have chapters on painful sex that really, I think that I was like a real pioneer in helping women understand what was going on and encouraging them to get most experienced medical support that they could. But, oh, look, for instance, with treating vaginismus, many couples would come to see me and their medical doctor and even their gynecologist would say to the husband, "Oh, just give her a couple of drinks of alcohol and make her relaxed." And, you know, that's ridiculous because it's not, you know, relaxation of the nervous system, it's relaxation of the pelvic floor. And you first have to understand that. And most women don't want to have alcohol in order to have sex. Many women don't have alcohol at all. So that was a real shame. And I'm very glad to say there are now pelvic floor specialists around Australia who do a really good job of making that assessment and helping the women get the best treatment to either desensitize the vulva or the pelvic floor and also help with their anxious thoughts and to normalize the fact that, you know, you can't be a porn star, that you need a lot of reassurance from your man, you need a lot of soothing and a lot of permission to take it at your own pace.
And how would you say that sex education has potentially played into this space, and also how has it changed over time? I know that when I went through you know, high school, where it was first introduced at least to my class, and I remember we segregated the classes specific for that conversation, so all of a sudden the boys went together and the girls were separated. It seemed to me, looking back, it was quite clumsy, and it's difficult to know because I can't necessarily recall how much I was taking in. There was lots of laughter and we were joking around as a bunch of boys. I do remember very little was covered and it was very broad brush. We at no point did we actually stop, I feel, and have a conversation about sex in any real way. Now that might may or may not be true. I don't understand, but how has it evolved, and how has it affected, you know, Australian sex lives? Like, what would you, how would you comment on that space?
Well, in the early days, most of the school education was just simply based on how not to get pregnant, how a baby's made, and very strongly how it's not a good idea to make a baby when you're 15 or even 16 in those days, 17. With boys, you know, they used to have the, here's a condom, and they'd put the condom over the banana and fill it with water and then try to break it. And that's funny, but it's really not educational, is it? Not in any way.
And that was my experience, you know.
Yeah, I bet.
The banana, the condom, laughing boys, and that was basically it. And everyone understood, don't get anyone pregnant.
I know, but they did, didn't they? They did before the pill. And before all the other, ways to prevent a pregnancy occurring, that has freed up that young population a lot more. And in schools, you know, they are now having very, very good sex ed courses, particularly for, say, year nines, when they're interested and keen. And yet there are, you know, very deeply religious schools where sex ed is not provided. And so, you know, I think that parents need to be very open, you know, very early, being ready to ask questions, answer questions, make young children who are growing up aware that something, sex is something that is universal, and that is how we make babies. And the best way to avoid making babies is to abstain until you're really, really, independently wise about how to make sure that you don't have the baby. So my book called Sex Wise, which was for teenagers and parents, it says, didn't sell very well. That was in 2001, I think it was. Didn't sell well at all. And the publishers were very, you know, like perplexed. And I said, I think it's because that's only like 23 years away ago. It's because the parents would be the market to buy the book, and they weren't buying the book. And the internet wasn't so easy for kids to, you know, to really access. So once again, they weren't getting that good education other than, you know, don't have sex. And often for some people, it was sex is a taboo. And so when we come back to our overseas immigrants, the melting pot of Australia, a lot of those young men did start watching pornography very young. And it was a thrill because it was forbidden. And particularly if they were still like going through puberty whilst they lived, let's say, I'm just using India as an example. I'm not pointing the finger there. But a lot of them became quite addicted to pornography. And one of the problems about that for young men who don't have a sense of permission and or even a sense of being able to go out with girls, get quite hooked, and then it becomes an addiction which is really starting to ruin their lives because they're not meeting girls, they're not experimenting, where, you know, a lot of the boy next doors in Australia are keen to experiment, and a lot of the girls are too, but our other friends just become virtually unable to ever have the confidence to pursue a partnership other than what's an arranged marriage.
I imagine that might be somewhat the story of many, in particular, boys who are afraid of, you know, that conversation, who are timid around that conversation, who aren't exposed to that conversation. They can still go out and privately on their phone or their device or their computer, go out and look at pornography and continue to avoid any conversation, so that pornography becomes their, I suppose, sex educator, but without any nuance, without any conversation, without any talk about whether this is something that represents reality or whether this is, you know, entertainment that's based on, you know, advertising revenue and the like. Young men must be finding it very difficult to be exposed to this material, yet not converse about it in an appropriate way and understand that there are many aspects to what sex is, and one of them might be entertainment and pleasure, but the others aren't so much explored, and therefore I suppose they're negated.
Yes, well, just recently a man came to see me about his sex life with his wife, where she wasn't interested and he had premature ejaculation. So basically she said, well, until you can learn to last, I'm not really interested in having sex. It's not pleasurable for me. It's over and done with. So he has an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old boys. And I said to him, so what are you teaching your boys about sex? And he said, oh, we don't talk about that. And I said, here's a really disturbing fact, that the average age a young boy independently pursues looking at pornography by himself is anything from 8 till 10. And he said, that's the ages of my sons. And I said, yes. And he said, oh, I'm so embarrassed. I just kept putting that talk off. And I said, look, it's so important that I used to bring it up, Nesh, when my kids were in the car on the freeway and they couldn't jump out of the car. Mostly it was about stranger danger. It wasn't, and also if my, if they were in just with me by themselves, because one's a boy and one's a girl. So it's a different way to approach it. But yeah, parents, and particularly fathers with boys and mothers with daughters, though there's no reason why we can't cross over those differences, but fathers with boys need to say that pornography is everywhere and easily accessible. And, I'm not wanting to tell them what kind of stand to make, but just to say, let's talk about it with their sons.
Mm-hmm. What is the problem in this? Is it because it's taboo, it's scary, adults are not confident in what they should or shouldn't say, we don't understand what is age appropriate, that we just avoid, we kind of tiptoe around the edges or just say something very short and move the topic, rather than maybe as parents clumsily going into those conversations, but still considering our language and being thoughtful around exploring the topics without necessarily having to be an expert around it. I mean, let's be truthful here. As young people, none of us were experts, and I would probably say even as adults, most of us are still not experts, because we haven't necessarily probably considered the tantric world or other explorative ways of loving our partners in different ways.
That's true. And there are so many opportunities nowadays in online media and particularly movies. Even for younger kids, there's opportunities to say, that they're kissing now because they feel that they are special to each other. And you can bring it up later on and talk about it in a way that we'd actually experience the world, don't shy away from it. And if you need to, go and see a sex therapist, parents, and find out what it is that might be holding you back from normalizing your sexuality with your children, whether it's the father or the mother, and make it a priority. In my clinic, I use the framework of the four ways that we connect with the human being, and that is from the spirit is the first one. And this is my bogan question, Nesh. You know what a bogan is? A bogan is, somebody that doesn't really educate themselves much about anything. And when I bring up that, our connection with somebody often can invite in a sense of spiritual connection, and they say, what's that mean? And I say, well, it's not something that's tangible. You can't touch it. It's just a felt sense that you are opening. I love the word intimacy. Into me, I can let you see. Intimacy. And then the mind. And that's where I say the mind is a minefield. And you can go deeper and deeper and deeper. Like, what did your parents teach you about sex? What sort of permission do you know? What sort of experiences you've had in the past? But deep, deep down, the bottom of your mind, ability to connect with somebody else, is your values. I say values are the bricks that we stand on, or we that we know what we stand for. So honoring, making sure that you have consent, being able to talk about your past sexual history if you think it's necessary in order to begin a relationship, sexual relationship. The building blocks, the values. Much better when you do find somebody who shares the same values when you're young. Can I tell you a story about a young woman who came to see me who was training to be a psychologist? She was about 23. And I like to, I did my English honours thesis, I did English honours as well as psychology, on The Lord of the Rings. And in those days, the professor said, you can't do that. It's pop literature. Well, when you look at when you look at the influence of The Lord of the Rings on the world now, it's like, yeah, well, you know, anyway. So I just loved the world of The Lord of the Rings. And this little girl, 23, looked like an elf. She had white, white, straight hair, beautiful big eyes. And she said, Dr. Jan, I want to learn how to have an orgasm with a partner. I can do it by myself, with my hand, with the vibrator, but I've never been able to orgasm with a partner. And I said, well, you know, what's your situation? You know, she said, oh, I have to study really hard to be a psychologist, so I haven't got a boyfriend. I go out on Friday night, and you get drunk and you pick up and you have sex, either in the back seat of a car, even up against a fence. And I said, and you expect you're going to have an orgasm when you're drunk? You don't know the person. You're not in a safe place. And she was kind of a bit, you know, like, oh, well, I guess I've never really thought about that. So it's just like hard to fathom, really. How promiscuous not just the men and the young women are, and also how still that misinformation. So I talk a bit more about orgasms, because this is one of the facts that studies have shown over and over. And I, on my website, which is sex-therapy.com.au, have done a questionnaire for 20 years now on how many women have intercourse orgasms. And we all concur that it's only about 25%. That's a quarter of women who can. We still don't really know organically why they can't, why we can't.
That's strange, Dr. Jan, because in pornography, it's 100% of women.
Oh, don't they just? Yes, every time. And, you know, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, it's over with. So, yeah, only a quarter of women can, the lucky, lucky ones. And also it can take so much more time and require so much more attention by their partner. And, of course, we're talking about all streams of sexuality too nowadays, women with women, men with men, whoever. In many, many ways, need to take their time. I talk about the five T's. This is how we remember the whole what we're here about. So the first T is how we think, getting our thinking straight. For instance, learning that only a quarter of women can have intercourse orgasms. So if your girl can't, don't blame her. Don't let her blame herself. Read up on it, study. There's so much wonderful information on the internet, aside from the porn, which is not so wonderful. So how you think, how you talk, being able to have those conversations. I'm working with a young man now who is very open in many ways, not shy. He's about 28, from Ireland, doing the backpacking thing around the world, really, but loving it in Australia. And he said that a one-night stand, he found that he had herpes. And now his position is, the dilemma is, should he tell a partner, particularly a girl he might pick up who's drunk in a pub, that, listen, I need to let you know that I have herpes, and then let her, it could be, you know, whatever, sex, let them know, have the choice as to whether or not they want to have sex or not with you. And I think that's so important that you, you know, you can't go around having sex willy-nilly like you, like maybe in the past. You need to disclose and be truthful and give the other person the choice. So talk. I do have another, I've got all these phrases that I repeat over and over, because I think the more you repeat things, the more people will remember.
Absolutely.
But I say there's the truth, and let me show you. Here's the truth, Nesh. That level is the truth. And that level is another story. A man came to see me. He was a GP and married late in life, had a bit of a playboy sex life. And he said, I found so we're talking about 40s when they marry, and the wife was very keen to have a baby, IVF, the whole thing, finally had a baby. And then she said, look, I don't care about sex anymore. I don't want to have sex. And he found an old diary of hers. And he said, Dr. Jan, my wife had sex with over 160 men. And I said, wow, that is probably a lot nowadays. I said, but how many women would you have had sex with? Well, only about 120. Now, when you are disclosing that sort of history, I call that not the truth, but the overwhelming truth. Nobody really needs to know that unless there's some reason for it. That is, you know, yes, I did get an STD. So be careful to tell the truth, but not the overwhelming truth, and tell the truth early before it's too late.
It's very much speaks to values work within acceptance and commitment therapy, where talking the truth is a very virtuous and lovely idea and idealistic, you know, concept. If we all tell the truth in a direct way or in a way that's not necessarily to the context, it's going to hurt. It's going to be painful. No different to, we don't tell children that when they, you know, kick a ball or they've written something, we don't say, oh, that's abysmal, that's terrible, you're not even trying, that's pathetic. What we do is we say, you know, great work, wonderful, you've done a really nice, you know, cursive writing there, or we provide some encouragement. We can still give a bit of truth and kind of say, you know, maybe you could work on X a little bit, or this is fantastic, try and push that, you know, element over here, or lovely kick, try and kick it with the side of your foot now. But to go out and just tell the whole truth in a different context is going to be harmful. So I like that, not telling the overwhelming truth can Absolutely. Still be, can still honor that concept of being honest, but it's done in a more nuanced way.
And sometimes through telling a story, you know, you can say, you know, one of my girlfriends did da 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 growing up, and I thought that was not something that I wanted to do, you know. So you're telling a story and you're kind of fibbing a bit, but you're really, you know, being able to express a story that you relate to. So far we've talked about how you think, getting your thoughts right about sex, how to talk truth but not overwhelming truth if you don't need to. And then there's three things that you can do when you're actually having sex. So there's touch, tongue, or thrust. So touch is any kind of sensual touch. And with tantric sex, we learn that it's not necessarily going to the genitals, that it can be very much a chakra experience, the actual centers of power, using the breath, all sorts of wonderful things to explore with tantric sex. So touch. Some women are getting addicted to their vibrators, because that sense of touch is often quick, over and done with, and does produce an orgasm. So not getting stuck in ways of touch, But learning how to do loving touch. I love to go for what's called a Lomi massage. It's not a sexual massage, but it's a very oily massage. And the Lomi stands for loving hands. So always coming to your partner with loving hands. So that's the touch. Tongue is being a really good kisser. And also oral sex for those people who are very, open to having oral sex. Lots of people still are not. And that's a shame if it's because you're not educated about it. So before you make judgments, do get educated. So it's touch and tongue and thrust. And thrust is not just with penis into vagina. And it could be in so many different ways around the body. Learning how to massage for a couple, I think, is one of the most loving things that you can do. And also because women do take, in general, time to warm up, doing the loving massage where they know that you're not going to go straight away for genitals is a wonderful way to make her feel safe, make her feel loved, and make her feel open to what's going to happen next. So it's certainly not just about thrust.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Jane, is that the fourth one? So we had think, talk, truth.
No, trust.
No,
this is all about the doing of it.
Okay, it's my apologies. Think, okay, yep.
Talk, and then it's touch.
Ah.
Tongue and thrust. Five okay. keywords.
Sure, okay.
Yeah.
Now I've got to thank you. Thank
it's pretty complicated, this whole thing about sex, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is where I imagine so much of the exposure of today's modern world around pornography is, I'm assuming, causing havoc. You know, these you know, thinking, talking, touch, you know, tongue, we don't as a society spend much time even having this conversation and kind of being a little bit scared of doing so with our children and trying to figure out what's appropriate. Certainly in schools, it's very difficult. And so the default is that kids will just see the exposure to it and probably, you know, the exposure on television is usually somewhat useful. You know, maybe as young kids, we see that, Cinderella ended up on the last page of the book was kissing a man, you know, the prince. They all find a prince and they kiss, and that's a first part of touch, I suppose, and kissing, some intimacy there. We don't really understand most of what goes on, other than everyone lives happily ever after, and maybe that's somewhat appropriate for kids as a starting point. But we don't get to see too much beyond that. We might watch a bit of television, and so we see some, you know, maybe some exposure of the body, and, you know, eventually if you're watching SBS, not that kids probably watch that anymore, but, you know, it used to be SBS where you might see, you know, breasts and little glimpses of the body. And then it kind of just moves on into almost nothing, other than porn now, which, you know, seems that it probably shows up on accidentally on kids search topics, you know, or at least somewhere along the Google front page of click on this one and off you go. So exposure rate is very high to porn, which doesn't talk about any of these concepts whatsoever. It goes immediately into adult entertainment, which you know, kids can't understand and parents are avoiding.
That's right. A couple of years ago, I was on a current affair talking about this very scary thing that was happening where they were taking, what's that pig called?
Oh, and Peppa Pig?
Peppa Pig. They were taking Peppa Pig cartoons and turning them into porn.
Oh, geez.
And then if parents didn't have a really good net nanny on, that porn could actually just pop up for the kids. And imagine how shocking that would be and traumatizing, you know, and we haven't really talked about the traumas that can happen to young people growing up. But, you know, getting over sexual trauma, whether it's to do with the thinking about it or whether it's because of an actual encounter, is like just such a huge aspect of sex therapy needs to be made easy for people to seek out and trust and work through. I had a girl who had vaginismus. She was married for 8 years and never been able to have intercourse with her husband. And she explained that her brother had been raping her from the age of 10 till 13. And when she told her mother, the mother said, "You're making it up. I don't want to talk about it." So you can see why somebody would be totally traumatized by that. And how wonderful it was of that husband that he said, "Look, let's just love each other. Let's have loving hands. Let's have sensual touch." And you know, like the intercourse part is not why I'm with you. So,
I imagine part of how one heals is prolonged repetitive exposure to, for example, loving hands.
That's right. Maintains
a gentle nature. That is one of compassion and kindness and love and intimacy.
Yes.
But one that doesn't necessarily have to result in penetration.
Yes. I'd like to think that we could take the whole porn penetration, you know, formula away. But, you know, that's the nature of porn. It's a nasty thing, I think. And, you know, I've really had to study it over the years and just been mortified by how quickly you can get sucked into the slippery slope of starting off with something that's, you know, like, okay, in terms of, oh, God, you know, this is a bit full on. And then suddenly you can be dragged into really nasty things. You know, some of the sex addicts with their porn have become, you know, in big trouble because of how that would lead to underage teen sex and maybe, you know, taking advantage of somebody that you might meet. So that's why I'm sorry if I come across as too black and white, but that's because I've had so many women and men. You know, there used to be, I had a gay guy who said, "You know, Dr. Jan, everybody thinks that a gay man can't be raped." And he said, "We sure can, you know, and we don't want to be."
I think that these are difficult conversations to have because they're not discussed regularly enough. If we discuss them openly on a regular basis, we wouldn't be so, you know, we wouldn't shy away from them. We wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't even be surprised by them. You know, the fact that 25% of women can orgasm and therefore 75% during sex and 75% can't. If we knew this as a regular general fact, kind of like, you know, the earth revolves around the sun. If we understood it that way, then so many women wouldn't be concerned about that. They would go, "Oh yeah, in actual fact, that's, you know, very standard, very normal. I fall into one of those. I either can or can't. And guess what? It doesn't actually even make a difference. You know, how I'm intimate with my partner makes a difference, and whether I do or don't over a lifetime is what it is. I'm assuming there's probably lots that can be said about how people can pleasure one another and connect with one another and be intimate with one another through things like, you know, whether it's education, through education, I should probably say, not just the tantric world, but education of connection, that you know, loving touch, for example. Can you talk a little bit about that work that you've done and maybe also the work that you do with your daughter around the tantric, you know, course and how that plays out? Because I imagine, I mean, certainly I don't know anything about it, and I'm assuming my listeners don't know very much about what that space looks like and who's it for and who might kind of entertain that idea and maybe go along to one of these courses and education sessions.
Yes, that would be great. Thank you. And to have women and men look at, well, what is tantric sex, and how can it enhance how we can be intimate together. So my daughter's name is Ella, and she says that I am the head doctor because I'm all about changing our thinking, and she is the holistic because it's all about the main principles. And I recommend that you ask Ella to come on for one of these wonderful podcast things that you do have, and that will, I think, ground people in what is tantric sex a lot better than what I can explain it. I still am coming from the head job, I call it. In one case, I had a woman who had five children and had never had an orgasm in any way. I think I worked with her monthly for a year on all the head stuff, and it wasn't until she was talking to Ella about getting into her body, being present, having no expectations, trusting, focus on the sensations, make the breathing big and deep and open, all of these ways of getting into your body. And she worked with Ella, and then she said, oh my God, now I am not necessarily vaginal orgasms, but she said, you know, my whole body has come alive. And just for those who may be interested, I was 60 when I went to have a tantric sex massage. It's called a yoni massage. We call, it's easy to teach people the Sanskrit words for sexual organs. And so the yoni is the vagina, but not just the vagina, the vulva, the everything. And so in a tantric sex with a woman, it's very much about the loving touch, the relaxing, using the breath. And then I did actually have my first, it's not the only one, my first whole body orgasm, which shouldn't be the goal, but is possible. And it just absolutely changed my life and opened up a whole new world. Highly recommend it, ladies.
And what's interesting that you say there, is something that I think comes up in psychology so much is understanding what a process is versus what the goal is. And so often the moment we experience something that is enjoyable, we flip that around and make that the goal versus the process. And obviously for young people, and I think that's why young people are very different in their sex lives, is the goal is having orgasm. And having sex so they can, you know, tell their friends. It's all about just going out and getting the, you know, air quotes, deed done. I can tell, you know, each of the respective parties can tell their story, and the status has gone up. At least in the early stages, but there's nothing about intimacy. And I say that, you know, on a general basis. I'm sure there's some exceptions to the rule, but I imagine that's how it happens. It's clumsy, it's quick, it's lots of fumbling around, and that probably goes on for many, many, many years. And as people mature, maybe they see sex as a different type of vehicle, not one that is purely about pleasure. But one that is about connection and intimacy, and thank you for sharing that story, because I think process is so important. And then if it does happen, then wonderful. But that should still not be the goal, because once again, you put pressure on it, and then you're trying to achieve something, and then, you know, your head gets in the way and says, oh, you know, am I getting there? I should be. My friends have, you know, I have to find this moment versus being present and in the moment. But I definitely am keen to hear a little bit more about this space from your daughter. I think that would be a lovely idea to have her on.
I'm sure she'd be very, very inspiring for all who watch and listen. Look, there's one more thing that I think we should really hammer home, and that is communication. Talking about sex out of the bedroom, and even planning for sex. So many people say to me, oh, you can't plan for sex because that's too mechanical. And I'll ask them back, well, you know, how many times are you having sex each month? And they go, oh, maybe 3 times in a whole month. And I said, well, why don't you get up on a Sunday morning and over a coffee, just look at your diaries and at least plan one occasion when you're going to be intimate. And for busy parents with little kids, there's no excuse for you not to be able to plan a time. Use the babysitters. And if you haven't got one, you know, the best babysitting thing you can possibly do, Nesh, put the kids in front of the Wiggles. So the parents might be upstairs or in the bedroom making love. It's probably just a quickie, not a longie, as I call it. But they're making love to the Wiggles. Isn't that funny? But true.
And it's lovely to also make light of this topic, which I think you do very well. Thank with your you. Language and phrases, because it does take away the fear. And, you know, I think parents can more comfortably have that conversation and joke about it. And there's a playfulness as well that comes out of that. And that also, I think, encourages parents to do so. You know, it's something that they can share, but also have a little bit of lightheartedness around. Dr. Jan, it's been an incredible pleasure to have you onto the podcast. Is there anywhere else that we could guide our listeners to in terms of where they can find out more about you? Maybe we can go through your website again, any of your book titles that would be useful for others to read up on if they wanted to take this topic further.
Yes, well, I'll give you all the links and lists in to have in your show notes. There are, like, as I said, about 18 audios. Several of them, or probably even, you know, a quarter of them, do have hypnosis as part of that. And that's because I find that hypnosis has the relaxing music, relaxing voice tone, the moving into it gently, where you can visualize a safe, honoring sexual encounter, which is so important for every you know, men and women to come instead of that bull with a gate, jump in, get it over and done with kind of thing. And hypnosis also for those who may have been traumatized, heaven forbid, by a relative. So lots of things, and so there's a hypnosis kind of audios. There's just informational audios, which you can play in the car, which is, you know, good choice when nobody else is in the car. And then there's the very brief, like 28 to 30 page PDFs, which can actually give you so much to do to fix a problem, to just get that correct information into your head. So yeah, come to Dr. Jan's Sexual University, and we get to that www.sex-therapy.com.au.
And we'll make sure that we put all of our links and different information on our show notes. So if you like, you can always go back to the end of this and click on, and that way you can get through to the website and continue to read further. Dr. Jan, thank you so much for your time and your knowledge and your vibrancy that you bring to this topic. It's refreshing, and I think it's a lovely resource for all of us to have, and I've certainly learned a lot this morning as well. So thank you.
You're welcome.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please support it by going to iTunes and putting a review. Subscribe, share it via social media, and tell others about it. Start a conversation. It's listeners like you that make this able and possible, and why we bring in these guests to go out and share their knowledge and resources. And just lastly, if you are a psychologist and you want to go out and be part of a bigger team, develop your experience and get into some exciting work, come to strategicpsychology.com.au/careers and reach out. I'd love to hear from you.